A great big hello to all you constant listeners out there in far middle land. Nick DeOlius coming to you from Pittsburgh, PA, in the month of March. And this episode's air date, it's nestled between St. Patrick's Day and the start of spring, which sounds great to me. And we've reached a milestone episode this week, number 200. That is awesome to see, and somewhat hard to believe that we've been holding our weekly sessions to engage in rational civil discourse for what is now a 200-week successive run. It's been a blast for me as a host, and I hope that you've had your share of enjoyment as a constant listener as well. Now, for the sports dedication I've got teed up for such an iconic milestone episode, I'm going to go with a nod to a form of sports art, specifically the art of the statue sculpture. The larger-than-life iconic statues that major sports cities and campuses all across the nation are adorned with. And I'm going to use my hometown of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to highlight the iconic sports art that you can find here in the form of statues. But you can go through a similar exercise for your favorite sports town of choice. Pittsburgh has more than a handful of great sports statues to choose from, as do most major cities. And I'm going to present the Mount Rushmore of sports statues in the Steel City, the Big Four, so to speak. Pittsburgh has a very rich sports tradition across three professional teams, also has a major college program as well. And fortunately, the city also boasts impressive and historic statues to commemorate some of those iconic names and moments from Pittsburgh sports lore. Now, if I had to pick a Mount Rushmore of my four favorite, I would choose three from the sport of baseball with the Pirates and one from the sport of hockey with the Penguins. I know some of you might hear three of the four coming from the Pirates and think, how could you choose three from a franchise that has struggled so badly the past 40 years? One of the worst track records in all of professional sports. Well, first, the Pirates have a very rich tradition that stretches and spans over a century. And second, when you can't have much to be happy about with the present, it's always helpful to lean back and rely on a glorious past. So maybe it's just a frustrated Pirates fan way of coping. Anyway, I will go in chronological order as to when my Mount Rushmore sports statues in Pittsburgh roamed the playing surfaces of their professions. So first up is the great Honus Wagner, who was a prior far middle dedication subject. His statue has been around the Steel City for decades, and it's moved as the Pirates have moved their home from Forbes Field to Three Rivers Stadium to now PNC Park. And it's a classic style bronze statue sitting atop a marble base dedicated in 1955. Second on the Mount Rushmore face is one that captures the ending image of the greatest ending in the history of the World Series, Bill Mazeroski's walk-off home run in Game 7 of the 1960 World Series against the New York Yankees dynasty team. Now, that's the game that made Mickey Mantle cry, and it also made countless Pittsburghers elated. Third on my Mount Rushmore for Pittsburgh sports statues is that of the one and only Roberto Clemente, Hall of Fame player and Hall of Fame human being. His likeness sits outside PNC Park around the corner from Honus. Created in the early 1990s, it captures Clemente in a dynamic swing. No pedestal for this one, with the sculpture sitting at ground level. Maz, Roberto, and Honus, they circumvent the streets around PNC Park. The fourth and final selection that I've got, it's the most recent and the only non-pirate on the mountain. And that would be number 66 himself, Mario Lemieux, sitting atop a wall outside the Penns Arena. And the sculpture is probably the most dynamic of the four, capturing a famous moment in the late 1980s when Mario split New York Islander defenders to score one of his many electric goals. Might be my favorite of the four statues. And indeed, those are my Mount Rushmore choices for Pittsburgh sports statues. I had to leave off that list Willie Stargell and Art Rooney, who's the founder, of course, of the Steelers. And those were tough things to do, but that's what's fun about Mount Rushmore discussions. What are yours for your sports town? Would love to hear from you on that one. Hit me up at nick@nickdeolius.com. Can only imagine how tough of a chore that would be for places like Boston and Philly and Chicago and New York. But it's a fun chore as well. Yes, we dedicate episode 200 to the art of sports sculpture and how it provides a legacy for future generations to tie back to the greats who once roamed those places. And with this being the 200th episode of The Farmiddle, it serves as a fitting point in time to announce to you a change in format and frequency for The Farmiddle. And like all good things in life, evolution is part of the process and journey toward continuous improvement. What I set out to accomplish with this podcast 200 weeks ago, it's not the same thing I'm aiming for today and into the future, largely because the past 200-week effort has been so satisfying. And the rolling out of the first dozen or so Farmiddle episodes way back when was to serve a very specific purpose, to discuss and summarize in sort of Cliff Notes format the main pillars and themes of my book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America. And some of you who were here from the get-go, you recall each episode, each week, back in those early episodes, they dove into a chapter of Precipice. And we released each chapter in full as a PDF on the then new nickdeolias.com website. So The Farmiddle was originally created and got rolling to discuss and frame up Precipice, the book. But after a dozen weeks or so, it was clear that The Farmiddle had potential to live on as a standalone podcast effort. And so it did. We introduced the James Burke-inspired connections each week, along with our sports dedication subjects. And we kept the weekly pace on a new episode every Wednesday. And there was so much ground the podcast had to cover back then. You know, that was at the start of the Biden administration, coming off of Trump's first term, in the midst of COVID and pandemic policy lunacy. It was, shall we say, a target-rich environment and one where rational and civil discourse, they were premiums, and The Farmiddle filled a void and role at the right time. Now, through the past 4 years or so, we never, ever suffered for lack of topics or content. Many episodes, they simply wrote themselves because of the interesting times that we lived within. The administrative state, climate policies, state of education, the zaniness in academia, workforce and job issues, urban, rural, and flyover America, government spending, ballooning deficits, and massive debt loads. Geopolitics, right, from China to Russia to the Mideast, and always interspersed across all of those themes, policy, policy, policy. Yeah, these past 4 years have been truly unprecedented nationally and globally. And The Farmiddle enjoyed the trove of issues to dive into each episode and then to revisit as yet new events unfolded. How would I sum up The Farmiddle's ethos? At its heart, there's a handful of core beliefs. And at the fore is the importance of the doers in our economy, the working men and women, the innovators, the risk takers, those who toil, often thanklessly, but that are vital to this society of ours functioning and improving. So many policies and musings from elites and experts, they look to undermine the doers these days. Someone, something, somehow needed to stick up for the doers, because if we lose them, when we denigrate them, we surely all lose. And right up there alongside the doers is a Farmiddle constant dedication to what I'd call flyover country, as in middle class, as in normal folk, as in Appalachia, as in the Midwest, or as in what flyover country is not, elite and expert classes. In many ways, the Farmiddle is dedicated to the people of flyover country, of prototypical America. Freedom of speech, another foundational theme of The Farmiddle. I've said a lot of things on many issues the past 4 years in this medium, and no one anywhere agrees with every single view I expressed. But you know what? I bet not a single person is out there who disagreed with every single view I proffered either. The point is not about what is the right or wrong answer or view. The point is freedom of expression exists as a pillar of what makes America, well, America. And we all have a right not to just respect that freedom when exercised by others, but also a duty to exercise it ourselves for things that we are passionate about. But the way one expresses freedom of speech, I believe that's important too. Hey, it's not a crime to be offensive, even if some consider it a microaggression. At least not yet, it's a crime. But that is no reason to abandon civil discourse. You can make a point and you can do it respectfully. And your point will resonate more if done in that manner, even if it might not get as many clicks or impressions as something done in a roguish manner. And that's probably the biggest issue that I have with the current president. I agree with many of his policies, and I believe his presidency to be incredibly important and timely. But he's got a way of how he says things or takes positions that doesn't always need to be that way. And it turns some people off, and that might hurt his ability to get things done and to strengthen his legacy. Civil discourse? Embrace it. One of the hidden drivers of the far middle. I'll tell you of another theme intertwined within the far middle DNA. The need to let facts best ideology. For substance to reign over optics, and for data and rational thought to beat speculation and the emotionally irrational. Too many policies recently were driven by the wrong things. We tried hard the past 200 episodes to bring example after example of that bad dynamic to the surface, to dissect and to analyze, to shed some rational light on the murky justifications for big, impactful policies. I can't escape this discussion of far middle manna without mentioning the supremacy of the individual in Western Republican democracies, to make sure the individual is never sacrificed at the altar of the collective. The individual should constantly be guarded and protected from the tyranny of the majority and from the wisdom of the elite expert. And then how about capitalism? Surely one of the core beliefs of this podcast is that capitalism makes everyone much better off than any other system known to man. Certainly, capitalism is far superior to what socialism and communism bring. Capitalism, it's not perfect, far from it, but it's the best economic system to elevate the human spirit that we've come across in history. And you know, the more we talk about this far middle ethos, I come to the realization that the far middle is a celebration of America. All those things that we just ran through, when you add them up cumulatively, you come up with America. And as many people through the years have observed, America is not a place. America is first and foremost an idea. The far middle pays homage to the idea of America with these themes, with all those connections. And the far middle takes on all comers that look to reduce or diminish the idea of America. Yeah, I think that's it. Now, people have asked me more than a few times over the past 4 years, what part of the far middle I enjoyed the most. I gotta tell you, my favorite parts were those ending connections of each episode. Most of them tying to music or film or literature. There was some culture and science that would find its way into those closing connections every so often. It was a fun and light way to end an episode after some heavy topics that were tackled prior in the episode. Now, if this sounds like, you know, a bit of a eulogy for the far middle, I apologize, because it is not meant to be that. The podcast lives on. We're not ending it, but it is changing, and that's how one improves. So what is it changing to? Well, one adjustment will be to frequency. We're evolving from the one episode a week posted each Wednesday to a random schedule. Episodes will be spaced out wider in time, maybe one to two per month, depending on the topic and timing, maybe one every 6 weeks or so. And the timing of new episodes will follow the content that drives the subject of each episode. And the content is going to morph into a deeper dive into a larger topic. So instead of a series of connections that are linked but independent, sort of the James Burke model, so to speak, now we're going to move to one singular theme or topic per episode. And we'll dive deeper into it for that episode. It's going to be a rewarding offer an experience, but it's going to take an even larger effort to prepare for it, thus the need for more time. Now, this is a judgment call, constant listeners, because I'll tell you, I mentioned it before, I'm not at a loss for content keeping the format that we've had for years running. It seems endless when it comes to the well of content. But I also feel, like I said earlier, that much of what I wanted to say from the themes in that wellspring, they've been laid out. And that I have other things I want to articulate. And that will require deeper dives, a little more time per episode. I need a modified platform to mine this new vein. And I'm really excited about getting into the mining. I think you will enjoy it. The topics are going to be random, episode to episode, and everyone will be unique, presented in a way you might never see coming. The far middle is going to become predictably unpredictable and uniformly unconventional. How about that? The new format will span a wide spectrum of topics. You'll get history, science, music, sport. You might encounter formatting and tools to assess the topics that are going to appear new to you. That's part of the goal. And the push is to take an issue of importance and or interest and then present it in a way that is unique to get conversation, awareness, discussion, to get those things going. So from that perspective, I suppose nothing has changed when it comes to the far middle mission. As Led Zeppelin put it, the song pretty much remains the same. And these new formatted episodes, they may run a bit longer than the 25 minutes or so that we fit prior years of the far middle into. But it's not going to be a hard, fast rule. It all depends on what the topic will demand to lay it out for further discussion. And also expect supplemental tie-ins to these new far middle episodes. Many will have graphics and many might come with a published piece to accompany the podcast on nickdeolias.com. Once again, it's all going to depend on individual topic, so flexibility, that'll reign supreme. I'd like to spend just a minute looking back on the catalog of 200 far middle episodes. It's amazing to see how themes that popped up time and again the past 4 years on the podcast, they firmly manifested into the agendas of the prior Biden administration and now also for the current Trump administration, but in the opposite direction, to the point almost of being consistent polar opposites. So what the Biden administration propped up and what it attacked were mirror images of what the Trump 2.0 administration is looking to promote and to eradicate. The big items in this polarity of the two administrations, they fell firmly within the power alley of the far middle. And it feels to me as if today there is so much attention on these topics that it creates a window for the far middle to evolve to the next level. The public discourse is flowing, albeit not always in a civil manner, and this podcast doesn't need to play a role in support of getting the discussion going. The nation's alive with a debate on a constant, intense basis. And by the way, I view that as great for the Republic. So now the far middle has a chance, in the words of Star Trek, to boldly go where no podcast has gone before. And who doesn't get excited about that? So off we sail into this new horizon. If you're in and you're going to stick with us, I am grateful. And as we close out milestone episode 200, both from a numerical as well as a content perspective, let's close with a discussion that connects to the theme of evolution and reinvention. It's what the far middle is going for with its new vision, and we can make a connection to that attempt in the world of music. What were some of the most impressive evolutions and new versions of bands in rock history? Where the successful act took its original brand as far as it could go, and then instead of playing it safe and making the same album over and over and playing the same set list over and over and doing the same tour over and over, the act instead decided to tear it all down and then replace it with something new. That comes with incredible risk, and it runs against the human nature trait of inertia. So when it happens and it works, it should be acknowledged and celebrated. So here are my Magnificent Seven of rock acts that were able to pull off the impressive feat of creating a successful style, then tearing it down and building a new one that achieved new heights. It's a rarity in artistic endeavors that are also commercial enterprises in the end. So first up is the progressive rock pioneers Genesis. I wrote an essay on this one that you can still find on nickdeolias.com. And this group, Genesis, they pulled off three eras of itself. The heavy prog rock first chapter with Peter Gabriel at front. The second generation version when Gabriel left to go solo and it saw Phil Collins take the mic, which was more rock with a slight flavor of those progressive rock roots. That era, by the way, is my favorite by far. And then the least interesting to me, the straight up commercial pop rock era of the heavy radio and MTV rotations. So hats off to Genesis, three versions of success of that band. Then there is U2, which we discussed way back in early far middle land when we ranked the band's albums. My favorite U2 album is Octoon Baby from the early 1990s, and that was a complete reinvention of the band. As Edge put it, the opening track of Octoon Baby was the sound of U2 chopping down the Joshua tree. They took a huge leap with that effort, and we all benefited from it. Van Halen is on my list of the Magnificent Seven. And this isn't tied to what you might think. It's not tied to lead vocals going from David Lee Roth to Sammy Hagar, because despite their different ranges and approaches, it was still clearly Van Halen at its core. Instead, the reinvention came from the genius maestro, the greatest guitarist in rock history, Eddie Van Halen, when he substituted the keyboard for the guitar starting on the groundbreaking album 1984. Now think about the guts that took. You're recognized as the greatest guitarist on the planet, and you put down the guitar and you take up the keyboards to create songs like Jump. Visionary. And by the way, you can read my ranking of the top 10 guitarists in rock history on nickdeolias.com as well. How about David Bowie? Got to be on this list, right? Think Ziggy Stardust, to the Thin White Duke, to his later work with Tin Machine. This guy was such a chameleon that he offers phases that I love to ones that ranged from where they didn't interest me all that much. But I was always waiting for what he rolled out next. Heck, I'm still discovering Bowie to this day, long after he is gone. Perhaps we all are. The Beach Boys is on this list, which is basically the same thing as saying Brian Wilson. Brian was to the Beach Boys what Eddie was to Van Halen. He was the driving and creative force. So the Beach Boys, they went from surf pop to the absolute glory of Pet Sounds, which I consider to be the greatest album of all time. And by the way, a big change in style for these guys came with the album right after Pet Sounds, the Smiley Smile record. Smiley Smile didn't do well commercially, and critics called it lo-fi. But the benefit of time shows how brilliant and bold of a switch in gears that was from Pet Sounds. It's an awesome chill-out album and followed the ultimate example of a rock album personifying art beauty that was Pet Sounds. I can't leave out the Beatles. The Beatles fans, they point to the jump from Rubber Soul to Revolver as one transformation. And of course, the epic Sgt. Pepper album, although I think that was sort of a Beatles attempt to answer the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds. But the Beatles are the Beatles, and certainly worthy on inclusion in the Magnificent Seven of revolutionary evolution and recreation. And then my last pick, to round out the seven, I think it's the most revolutionary example on this list, and the most evolutionary, the bravest when it came to change, Bobby Dylan. There is no career or catalog that rivals this American poet from Hibbing, Minnesota. He came out as an acoustic folk icon with the counterculture, sort of a Greenwich Village beat poet to the core. Then he went electric. What a controversy that was. His mentor, Pete Seeger, lost his mind and people booed the legend at Newport. But Dylan was just warming up with his evolution and change. His career has been one built on creation, then tearing down, and then new creation, one cycle after another. There was the reclusive period after his motorcycle accident, where he disappeared but still put out great works like the Basement Tapes. The evolution continues to this day with him as he continues doing what he does well into his 80s. And what's unique about Dylan's evolution of creation and style is how much of it mirrored personal and life changes with him. So when he became a born-again Christian, his music, lyrics, and albums tracked that conversion. So this wasn't the optical change or just the visual change like you would find with a Bowie or U2. This was substantive evolution from within the man and his soul. And there will never be another Bob Dylan, all six versions of him. And there will never be another Far Middle, constant listeners, especially with this new chapter about to dawn. And until we talk again on that new horizon, always stay connected to that Far Middle.